A vote was taken on whether to include the borders of the partition plan in the declaration, and Ben-Gurion, Kramer records, won the argument by a single vote. Of course, this had profound implications, not only for how the declaration spoke about the general borders of the Jewish state, but also for how it spoke about Jerusalem. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 196, Preparing for War and Independence. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It was on May 13th that the Manhelet Am, the members of the governing body of the Yishuv, gathered at the home of David Ben-Gurion to discuss the process by which the Jewish state would come into being. According to the United Nations partition plan, the British mandate was to come to an end Friday night at midnight, with the beginning of May 15th marking the conclusion of British rule. It was the preparation for this moment that would mark Ben-Gurion's finest hour. It is well known that as the entire Yishuv celebrated the United Nations' approval of the partition plan in 1947, Ben-Gurion, rather than celebrating, soberly pondered what it would take to defend the Jewish state that was to be born. This drove him to single-mindedly oversee the purchase of weapons and materiel that would help turn Israel's soldiers into an army. This achievement has been succinctly summarized by the historian Anita Shapira. She wrote, quote, Ben-Gurion had to instigate a conceptual, organizational, and functional revolution. He had to inculcate in the Haganah command the concept that they were an army, not a militia, to redefine the enemy, and to build the organizational and command tools for dealing with the new reality. He was haunted by a feeling that time was short and that the very existence of the Yishuv hung in the balance. And Shapira adds, it was difficult to convey to the Haganah commanders, who were used to a certain pace and scope of action, his belief that this time they would be fighting a different war against regular forces that mandated a different level of preparedness, end quote. Thus war, certainly, in 1948, in May, was very much in Ben-Gurion's mind. But so was the text through which independence would be declared. As discussed in the new excellent book on Israel's Declaration of Independence by Neil Rogachevsky and Dov Ziegler, the draft over which the Manhelet Am labored at that meeting was most recently the product of the work of Moshe Sharet, who had himself been most recently guided by the proposal of the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, UNSCOP, whose proposal had led to UN Resolution 181 that suggested a division of Mandate Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab one with an international city of Jerusalem. Resolution 181 also proposed that after the mandate expired, the UN would step in, with a Jewish state coming into being several months later, in October. Charette and others believed that the Declaration of Independence should reflect what had been laid out in Resolution 181. Neil Rogachevsky and Dov Ziegler describe the debate that took place at that meeting. Quote, the Manhelet Am was strongly divided over how to proceed. One camp followed the logic of Moshe Shertok's draft and argued that it was best to declare a state in what they termed the framework, literally enclosure, miskeret of the United Nations, thereby committing the state, at least in theory, to the terms of independence and political logic that the United Nations had set forth the prior November. Though the British mandate was set to expire on May 15th, the United Nations had specified October 1 as the date in which this new political arrangement would come into place. And so, if the Yishuv were to follow the letter of the United Nations resolution, a declaration of independence in May would only be a provisional declaration of independence, since the new entities specified by the UN were only supposed to come into being in October 1948, end quote. Thus, there was the proposal of Moshe Sharet, originally Moshe Shertok, as to how the declaration should coincide with Resolution 181. As Neil Rogachevsky and Dov Ziegler go on to explain, Ben-Gurion very much disagreed with Moshe Sharet's approach. After all, Arab leadership had opposed the resolution, and war was descending. There was therefore no possibility that the United Nations would actually enforce the partition plan by preserving Jewish independence within the borders suggested in Resolution 181. In the end, it would fall only to the Jews themselves in the Holy Land to ensure survival of the newborn Jewish state. Why then, Ben-Gurion argued, should the declaration be bound by the United Nations resolution? Should the text not declare that an independent state was beginning fully, not in October, but right then, in May? At this juncture, the authors tell us, quote, Ben-Gurion received crucial help from Golda Meirson, later to be known as Golda Meir, Israel's fourth prime minister. Meirson had just returned from a secret meeting with King Hussein of Jordan. She had attempted to persuade the Hashemite monarch not to invade the Jewish state. Golda had bad news to deliver on this front. The king could not be swayed. Through her burgeoning diplomatic experience here, combined with her lifetime of Zionist organizing in different countries, Golda had developed the ability to see to the essential in questions. End quote. Golda Meir sided with Ben-Gurion, making the case that given that war was inevitable, the UN resolution should not determine the words of the declaration. Or as the author summarized the argument, quote, politically speaking, the UN resolution had lost all ability to compel. It may have maintained a certain nominal or formal right, but it had lost all power, and the procedures themselves had no moral worth. They were mere procedures. And so with the UN failing to live up to its end of the bargain, it fell to the Jews to determine their own political reality. And that political reality would be served by the declaration of a state with no asterisks, a state that was not limited by UN resolutions. As these authors and historian Martin Kramer note, the question of how carefully the declaration should parallel Resolution 181 and the proposal of UNSCOP was related to another important issue that was also debated at this meeting. Should borders be specified for the newborn Jewish state in the Declaration of Independence? Here, Ben-Gurion put forward an incredibly important argument. It is often said that Ben-Gurion cast the deciding vote among the Zionist executive in deciding to declare independence in May of 1948. But as Martin Kramer has noted, the evidence in the end militates against this. He explains that in fact it was understood that independence would be declared, and for two reasons. Quote, first, the decision to declare independence as of May 15 had already been taken in Tel Aviv a month earlier by the Zionist Executive Council, the highest body of the Zionist organization. This, quote-unquote, declaration of political independence, issued on April 12, was largely written by Zalman Rubashov, later Shazar, future third president of Israel, who read it aloud in a dramatic midnight session. The Zionist Executive Council, the highest body of the world Zionist movement, declares today its decision to establish in the country the high authority of our political independence. End quote. Thus, Kramer argues, independence was definitely going to happen. And as Kramer further notes, there was another reason why not only Ben-Gurion, but others in the Yeshuv leadership understood that independence had to be declared. Quote, second, all in the room knew that if they didn't declare the state, someone else would. End quote. This, as Kramer explains, refers to Begin. It was therefore understood, Kramer argues, that independence had to be declared. But, as Martin Kramer, as well as Neil Rogachevsky and Dov Ziegler note, Ben-Gurion was critical in convincing his colleagues not to define the borders of Israel in the declaration based on ones set up by the United Nations in its original partition plan. And, fascinatingly, Ben-Gurion's argument was not only that the Jews would not be bound by the UN resolution because of the fact that the UN would not defend Israel, but also, as all these authors note, Ben-Gurion pointed out that another very famous Declaration of Independence made no mention of borders, and that is the American Declaration of Independence. After all, there too, the colonists were declaring independence, and there too, they were preparing for war following this declaration. But they did not in any way set out the borders of the United States that was being brought into being. Those borders, they understood, would be defined by war. A vote was taken on whether to include the borders of the partition plan in the declaration, and Ben-Gurion, Kramer records, won the argument by a single vote. Of course, this had profound implications, not only for how the declaration spoke about the general borders of the Jewish state, but also for how it spoke about Jerusalem. While the partition plan had assumed the internationalization of the city, Ben-Gurion had made sure that the declaration would in no way imply that Jerusalem should be internationalized. As we've discussed in a previous episode, Ben-Gurion oversaw one of the legendary moments in the battles leading to independence, Operation Nachshon, the breaking of the Arab siege of the city in order to bring its Jews sustaining supplies. Precisely because war rather than partition was what was embraced by the Arab armies, Ben-Gurion knew that every effort must be made militarily in order to ensure that Jerusalem was part of the new Jewish state. And it is this agonizing and essential effort that would occupy much of the mindset of Ben-Gurion and of so many others as they prepared for independence and for a date that would mark a turning point in Jewish history. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.